Chapter 14. No sooner had Link gotten behind the wheel of the pig and fired the engine than Mark Murphy opened the truck's voice-activated communications system. Call Max. The ringing of a telephone sounded inside the off-road vehicle. The pig was so well built they could barely hear the engine as Link guided the truck out of its hiding place and pointed its blunt snout toward the Tunisian border. A voice no one recognized answered the call. Max's Pizza, is this for pickup or delivery?
Be something if they would deliver, Link said. I could go for a slice.
Sorry, wrong number. Mark cut the connection and tried again. Call Max Hanley. This time Max's voice muttered hello when the phone was answered.
Max, it's Mark Murphy. I'm in the pig with Linda and Link.
Glad you finally called, Max said. The stuff's hit the fan since you went dark.
I can imagine. Are you in the op center?
Yeah.
Have someone pull up the screen for the bio-tracking chips.
Just a second. There was a moment's pause. While they waited, Mark used the pig's computer to jack into the Oregon's closed-circuit television system so the image of the futuristic control room popped up on his screen. Max was standing next to the communications station, watching over the duty officer's shoulder.
That's interesting, Hanley muttered. I have the three of you heading west at 40 miles per hour, presumably in the powered investigator ground, while the chairman is going northeast at 100 miles an hour. What happened? You guys get into an argument?
Funny. Make sure you stay on him. We're on our way to the Tunisian border. Juan's with the people we're certain brought down the secretary's plane. We don't believe she's dead.
Did you say the plane was brought down?
I did, and I don't think Fiona Katamora was on it when it crashed.
How the hell did they pull that off?
Tell me in a second. You'd better hightail it out of there. 20 minutes ago, the Libyans announced that they've located the wreckage, and their government has given permission for a team from our NTSB to examine it. They had been pre-staged in Cairo and will be in Tripoli by noon, but I'm sure the Libyans will be swarming that area sooner.
They're not going to find anything, Mark told him. A team of men came in on a chopper to demolish the site and ruin any chance of a reconstruction. They moved wreckage around, took some away, and smashed up just about everything they could lay their hands on. They even brought a lame camel to lay tracks all over the place.
A lame camel?
To make it look like nomads had done the damage, Mark explained.
Someone's thinking a couple of steps ahead, Max grunted.
Is the NTSB coming to Libya, general knowledge? Linda asked.
No. Langston told me it was cleared at the highest levels and kept under wraps.
That means the Tangos have a source in the government if they knew to come back and mess with the wreckage.
Or they're government-sponsored, Max countered.
Mark, you said you don't think Secretary Katamora was on the plane.
There's pretty convincing evidence that the plane landed in the desert before the crash.
You think they took her off?
Why else would they land it, take off again, and slam it into a mountaintop? They want the world to think she's dead.
What do they gain by that?
Come on, Max, Linda said. She's the damn Secretary of State. She's either an intelligence coup for these people or the best bargaining chip in history. Remember, she was the last president's national security advisor. If we think she's dead, we aren't going to be looking for her. They could extract information from now until doomsday and we'd never be the wiser.
There was a pause in the conversation as all of them digested the implications of Linda's theory.
The terrorists getting their hands on Fiona Katamora was probably more damaging than if they had kidnapped the president. As a politician only in his first year of office, he was kept away from the operational minutiae that went into fighting the war on terror. Because of the positions she'd held over the years and the insatiable ability of her mind to absorb details, Fiona knew more about America's ongoing operations and the nation's plans for the future than the chief executive.
We have to get her back, Max said.
There was no need to respond to such an obvious statement.
Is there anything else going on that we need to be aware of? Mark asked.
Yeah.
Langston forwarded information about a mission on behalf of the State Department being carried out in Tunisia, very close to the Libyan border.
States running ops now? Link asked.
It was cleared through Langley, and they sent a minder along with the team. It was given medium priority because there wasn't much of a chance for success.
What are they doing in Tunisia?
Max explained about the letter that first came to light through St. Julian Perlmutter and how it related to the historic pirate Suleiman al-Jama during the Barbary Wars. He told them of the belief that the old corsair might have left writings in a hidden cave someplace along a dried-up river course that expounded on ways Islam and Christendom could coexist peacefully.
"Does sound like a long shot," Linda said when he finished. "Is this connected to the plane crash?"
It's kind of coincidental that these two events happened around the same time and near the same place, but there's no hard evidence of a link. The secretary wasn't even aware of the expedition. It was handled by an undersecretary named Christy Valero. Apparently, she thought it was worth trying for. And for whatever it's worth, so do I. Pronouncements from influential clerics carry a tremendous amount of weight in the region. It was the Ayatollah Khomeini who declared that anyone who commits an act of suicide while engaged with the enemy shall be considered a martyr, Linda finished for him. We know our history, Max, and I'm willing to bet you just learned that little factoid when you spoke with Overholt.
Hanley didn't deny it. Anyway, three of the four people state sent to Tunisia are now considered missing. They had been given permission by the local government chaperone to stay away from the camp for 72 hours, but their truck's overdue.
The supposition at Langley is that this is connected to Fiona's abduction, right? Mark asked doubtfully.
They're not supposing anything, Max replied with a tone that said he didn't give a whit for Mark's skepticism. But Lang wants us to check it out anyway.
Linda said, I don't think that's a good idea. We just saw Juan fly off with either a group of terrorists or members of Libya's special forces. But either way, they're involved in the crash. We shouldn't be traipsing across the desert searching for lost archaeologists when he could need us at a moment's notice.
Hold on a second, Murph interrupted, a hint of excitement in his voice.
Where's Stoney?
He's not on duty right now, so he's probably in his cabin.
Max, pipe this call down to him and we'll be right back.
Max made the switch. Eric Stone came up on a webcam a moment later, slurping from an energy drink.
Hey, how's it playing, Lawrence of Arabia? He said in greeting.
Are you bogarting my Red Bull? Murph accused.
Eric quickly pulled the can out of camera range.
Nope. Jerk.
Listen, when we were checking the satellite pictures, we spotted an abandoned truck out in the open desert not too far from our flight path estimates.
I remember.
Flash me a close-up and give me the GPS coordinates.
Hold on.
Eric glanced down from the webcam and started typing at his computer. Over his shoulder, an online gaming avatar that looked like a toad in medieval armor had been set by a macro program to grind out points by repeatedly arranging a basket of flowers.
Looks like a real badass game you're playing, Eric, Link remarked when he glanced over at the computer screen in front of Murph. Let me guess, Sir Ribbit and the Bouquet of Death?
Stone looked over his shoulder, saw that he could never explain what he was doing to a warrior like Link, and killed that computer screen with a remote control.
Okay, I've emailed the GPS numbers and a zoom shot of the truck. I'm now looking at your tracking information. You're only about 100 miles from it. Shouldn't take more than a couple of hours.
As the crow flies, Stoney, not as the pig crawls, but thanks.
Would you also send that picture to the main screen in the op center and route this call back to Max?
On its way.
Talk to you later.
Is that their truck? Mark asked Hanley as soon as he'd reestablished contact.
Overholt said it had some kind of drill rig on the back, so I'd say it is. How did you know where to find a picture of it?
I'm a genius, Max, Murph replied without a trace of irony. You know that.
Okay, genius. You just bought yourself a detour. I want you guys to check out the truck, and then I need you to interview the fourth member of the search team,
a Dr. Emil Bumford. He's still at the Roman archaeological site that the State Department team was using as cover. He's already spoken with the Undersecretary at State who set this up. From what Lang told me, Bumford's useless, but a face-to-face might get us something.
What about the chairman? Linda persisted. I feel like we're abandoning him.
Sweetie, Max soothed, this is Juan Cabrillo we're talking about. With his luck, that chopper's headed to some 5-star seaside resort, and 10 minutes after they land, he'll have a drink in one hand and a woman in the other. It took the better part of 8 hard hours to cross the desert to where Eric and Mark had spotted the abandoned drill truck on the satellite pictures. The landscape was a fractured plain of endless hillocks and riverbeds that rattled their organs until they felt their bodies were nothing more than liquid held in check by their skin. Mark and Linda had switched places, so she rode shotgun next to Link. He drove in a loose-armed, relaxed pose, as if the rough terrain were no more bothersome than an occasional pothole on an interstate highway. As the sun hovered over the distant horizon, they were approaching the GPS coordinates Eric Stone had provided. The pig was still performing as advertised, and their remaining fuel was just enough to get them across the border into Tunisia. There they would need to find diesel. Link was hoping they could buy a supply at the archaeological site, but most likely it would need to be choppered in from the Oregon. He would have to call Max about making the arrangements so they could sling a bladder of diesel under the corporation's new McDonnell Douglas MD-520N. With its hook-lifting capacity of a ton, George Adams, their pilot, could more than handle the fuel needed to fill the pig's many tanks. Something sticking up from the otherwise barren desert caught Link's attention. It was less than a quarter mile off to their left. He wasn't sure what it was. From a distance, and in the uncertain light, it appeared to be pulsating. He pointed it out to Linda and Mark. Neither knew what to make of it. They were a mile from the abandoned truck, but Link felt it was worth a look, so he parked the pig behind a low dune and killed the engine. "Mark, grab me my Rec 7, will you?" Link asked. Next to him, Linda drew a Glock 19, the compact version of the 17, one of the most popular combat pistols in the world. Mark opened the door to the rear compartment and handed Link his assault rifle. Not as proficient with small arms as he was with the Oregon's state-of-the-art arsenal, Murph tucked an antique model 1911 45 caliber pistol into the small of his back when he unlimbered his lanky frame from the truck. The three of them kept in a crouch and used natural cover to approach the unknown object thrust up from the ground. When they were 50 yards off, they heard an obscene crying sound, something that wasn't human, but still reminded them all of an infant's scream.
"What the hell is that thing?" Mark asked with superstitious dread.
Link was just ahead of the other two, his rifle tucked high against his shoulder as he peered intently, trying to understand what he was seeing. The object looked like an inverted cross, but there were two dark shapes moving on either side of the cross, shuffling around in an ungainly motion. Then one of the shapes spread a pair of wide black wings, and Link knew immediately what he was seeing. A man had been crucified with his head pointed toward the ground, and a pair of bald-necked vultures was sitting on the crux of his underarms. The feathers around their heads were matted with gore as they feasted upon the corpse. One had torn off a strip of flesh that now hung in its beak. It jerked its head back and forth to force the meat down its gullet. Link knew from an experience in Central Africa when he was with the SEALs that no warning shot in the world would chase the repugnant birds from their favored carrion. He fired for effect, putting 2 rounds downrange, and the vultures were blown off their unholy perch. A couple of feathers drifted lazily on the slight breeze and settled a few feet away from their bodies.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!"
Mark Murphy kept repeating, but to his credit, he stayed with Link and Linda as they drew nearer. The birds had inflicted unspeakable wounds to the body. They'd had days to tear and rip into the man's flesh, but there was enough recognizable to see he was Caucasian, and he'd died from a single bullet to the head.
Because of the blood that had soaked into the ground below the crucifix, it was impossible to tell if he'd been shot before or after he'd been strung up. Being only a mile from the drill truck, it wasn't a leap in logic to assume that this was what remained of one of the State Department people. In Link's mind, he could concede that the terrorists might have felt that killing the man had been an operational necessity. But the desecration of his body in an intentional perversion of Christ's death had been done merely for the fun of it. Without a word, Link started back to the pig to get a shovel. The grisly task took 20 minutes in the soft soil, and when he was finished, only a thin sheen of sweat greased his torso and shaved head. While he worked, Linda and Mark cast ahead for the truck, only to discover it had been moved since the satellite flyby. They found clearly defined tire tracks leading off to the west. They also saw a second set of tracks from a vehicle lighter than the drill truck. Between the two sets of tracks was a single brass shell casing that still smelled of gunpowder, and a red-black stain in the earth that was being painstakingly cleared away, one sand grain at a time, by columns of ants. When they told Link what they'd seen, all agreed that the State Department team had inadvertently crossed the border into Libya, where they had been discovered by a patrol. For some reason, one of their party had been shot in the head and the others taken prisoner. The body had been driven a short distance and crucified. "It's possible they saw Katamora's plane fly overhead," Mark suggested. "Realizing it was in trouble, they might have decided to investigate." "And they just happened to run into a border patrol?" Linda's comment was more a dubious statement than a question. "Not a border patrol," Link countered, sensing where Linda was heading. "The terrorists sent out teams along the projected flight path to eliminate anyone who saw the plane. Judging from where the ambush took place, the state people were well south of their own base camp," Mark pointed out. "They were in the right place, only it was the wrong time." "What do you want us to do?" Link asked Linda Ross. As the corporation's vice president of operations, she was the ranking member on the team. She considered calling Max and leaving the decision up to him, but Hanley hadn't seen the condition of the body, couldn't feel what she'd felt at that moment when she realized what it was. When it came to tactical matters, Linda rarely allowed her emotions to interfere with her decisions. No good commander does. However, this time, looking at her companions, she knew the right call was to go after the butchers who did this. With luck, they would take one alive. It was doubtful a foot soldier would know the overall plans these people had for the Secretary of State, but any intelligence was better than nothing. "They've got a hell of a head start," she said, her jaw barely moving because of her anger. "Don't matter to me," Link said. "If it makes it easier," Mark said, "there's a 50-50 chance the two other Americans were taken prisoner when the Libyans took their truck." Linda hadn't thought of that, and it was the last piece of information to cement her decision. "Mount up." Tracking the drill truck's tire tracks across the desert was as easy as following the dotted lines on a country road. The vehicle was heavy enough that the marks hadn't yet succumbed to the constant scouring of the wind. And when the sun sank over some distant mountains, Mark activated the pig's FLIR system. Designed for attack helicopters, the forward-looking infrared system could detect ambient heat sources and would give them a warning many miles off if they approached the warm engine of the truck. Link strapped a pair of night vision goggles over his head. Using both passive and active near-infrared illuminators, he could drive comfortably in total darkness if necessary. However, the quarter moon rising behind them gave the third-generation system more than enough light. No one spoke as they drove across the wasteland. There was no need. All three of them shared the same thoughts, the same concerns, and also the same desire to avenge the dead man. None of them cared about the bumps and ruts that the powerful truck bulled through. What the massive shock absorbers couldn't take, their bodies would. "How far are we from the Tunisian border?" Linda asked after a couple of hours. Mark checked their position on his computer. "About 8 miles." "Keep sharp."
I doubt they'll cross it. The ghostly shadows cast by the risen moon suddenly winked out as a curtain of clouds crossed in front of it. Link's NVGs didn't have enough light to process, so he keyed the active illuminators, sending out wavelengths in the near-infrared spectrum that were undetectable to human vision, but which showed clearly in his goggles. They drove like that for another mile. Mark Murphy was well aware that the active signal from Link's goggles could be seen by anyone else equipped with a night vision device, so he never took his eyes off the FLIR. So far, the desert ahead remained completely dark on the thermal scans. And then a tiny blip showed itself. It was too small to be a man, he thought, and he dismissed it as some nocturnal animal, when suddenly a burst of light exploded in the truck's cabin across nearly every wavelength. The hot exhaust from an RPG showed like a streak of white lightning on Mark's screen, while Link's NVGs were nearly overwhelmed by the blast of the rocket motor. They had stumbled into a perfectly laid ambush, and had the man with the grenade launcher fired a moment sooner, they would have been blown apart in the opening salvo.